It's the morning of January 16th, 1979, in Tehran, Iran's capital city. From the back seat of an armored car, a gray-haired man in a black suit and winter coat gazes blankly out the window, listening to the solemn rumble of the engine. For almost 40 years, Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi has ruled as Iran's head of state, enjoying a life of extravagant wealth and unbridled power. But on this gloomy, overcast morning, the Shah has been forced into exile. Following increasingly violent demonstrations against his regime, the self-styled King of Kings has decided to leave the country until it's safe to return. Beside him, the Shah can hear his wife, the Empress, softly weeping. He reaches out and gives her hand a reassuring squeeze. But as he does, the 59-year-old Shah turns his face away. He doesn't want the Empress to see the tears brimming in his eyes. A short while later, the royal motorcade arrives at Tehran Airport. The Shah and the Empress emerge from the car and walk arm in arm across the tarmac. A small throng of government officials and reporters surround the imperial couple as they make their way toward their private jet. But as the royals approach the aircraft, somebody lunges from the crowd. The Shah recoils instinctively, but it's not an attacker. It's a member of the imperial guard who has thrown himself to the ground at the Shah's feet, bowing and reaffirming his devotion. Touched, the Shah tells the man to stand and thanks him for his loyal service. Then the Shah and the Empress climb the steps to the plane. Before withdrawing into the cabin, the Shah turns to take one final look at his troubled kingdom. Fighting back more tears, he declares to those assembled in a wavering voice that what Iran needs is cooperation between all its inhabitants to set the country back on track. And with that, the Shah turns and disappears inside the aircraft. The exile of Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi spells the end of 2,500 years of imperial rule in Iran. In a matter of weeks, Iran will go from being a liberal pro-Western monarchy to a radical Islamic theocracy, which will have permanent and wide-ranging implications for the future of the Middle East. But although the Iranian Revolution ends abruptly, its roots stretch back decades. Woven from a complex narrative of meddling foreign powers and opposing ideologies that culminates in the exile of Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi on January 16, 1979. From Noiser and Airship, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is History Daily. History is made every day. On this podcast, every day, we tell the true stories of the people and events that shaped our world. Today is January 16, 1979. Iran's last Shah flees the revolution. It's October 26, 1967, 11 years before the Shah will flee Iran. A lavish coronation ceremony is taking place in Tehran. Beneath gleaming crystal chandeliers, Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, Iran's king and head of state, processes solemnly through the opulent Grand Hall of the Imperial Palace. At the age of 48, the Shah is already more than two decades into his reign. Iranian monarchs are traditionally crowned upon their ascension to the throne. But when Mohammad Reza Pahlavi succeeded his father in 1941, Iran was in a state of economic turmoil. The young Shah looked around at the kingdom he'd inherited and decided he didn't want to be crowned emperor of such a poor and backward country. So he decided to delay his coronation until Iran could claim to be a prosperous, modern nation. Now that day has finally arrived. The Shah steps forward and takes hold of the crown with both hands. He raises it up, then lowers the weighty gold symbol of power onto his head. As he does so, the Shah reflects on how far Iran has come since he first ascended to the throne 26 years ago. Back then, Iran was a country in chaos. A fierce debate was raging over who should have access to Iran's primary natural resource, oil. At that time, the Iranian oil industry was controlled by a British company. Millions of tons of petroleum flowed out of Iran every year, powering Western industry, while Iran remained poor and undeveloped. Many felt that Iran alone should profit from Iranian oil, prompting the prime minister at the time, Mohammad Mossadegh, to nationalize the oil industry and forbid the British from drilling in Iran's petroleum fields. But the British refused to go quietly. In 1953, a coup d'etat was launched by Britain and its ally, the United States. With the support of the Shah, who quickly succumbed to Western pressure, the attempt to forcefully remove Prime Minister Mossadegh from office was a success, and a deal was struck between the Shah and the Western powers, agreeing to share the profits from Iranian oil between them. The Shah used these new oil revenues to reinforce his authority. He enlarged the imperial army and created his own secret police force, the SAVAK, to crack down on political opposition. Iran is technically a constitutional monarchy. Authority is divided between the Shah and his government. But since 1953, the Shah has been veering steadily towards authoritarianism. He has been helped in this regard by the United States, who sees Iran as a strategically important ally against the Soviet Union. Each year, the U.S. provides Iran with millions of dollars in aid, leading many Iranians to accuse the Shah of being a puppet ruler controlled by the Americans. Certainly, the Shah's fondness for Western culture is no secret. He listens to jazz, watches Hollywood movies, and owns a vast collection of European sports cars. He also prefers Western women, earning a reputation as a philandering Lothario. Rumors about the Shah's various infidelities have not gone unnoticed by his wife, the Empress. Nor have his excesses escaped the attention of the Iranian public, many of whom are traditional Muslims who disapprove of the Shah's material greed and vanity. Today, however, any concerns about his public image are far from the Shah's mind. With the Empress by his side, the monarch stands and smiles out at the assembled dignitaries and members of the royal family. Today's coronation is the culmination of his reign, a statement to the world that the 2,500-year-old Persian Empire has been restored to its fullest glory. Following the coronation, the Shah's grip on power only tightens. With the financial support of the U.S., he continues his campaign of rapid industrialization, known as the White Revolution, a series of reforms intended to bring Iran into the modern world. The reforms are largely a success. National infrastructure grows, employment rises, and wages soar. Women are given the right to vote, and a greater degree of religious pluralism is permitted. But while these liberal reforms are looked upon favorably in the West, in Iran, the Shah's policies alienate a large and powerful majority in the country, the devout Muslim population. Of the Shah's many critics, one figure emerges as his fiercest opponent, a charismatic religious leader, the Ayatollah Khomeini. Khomeini denounces the Shah in public speeches, accusing him of cozying up to the West. And when the Shah's government forces Khomeini into exile, the Ayatollah continues to publish anti-Shah literature from abroad, stoking the fires of dissent in Iran. In the face of this gathering opposition, the Shah begins ruling with an ever stronger iron fist. He authorizes his secret police, the SAVAK, to carry out arrests and interrogations at will. But such intimidation only galvanizes the Shah's critics further. Then, in 1974, the Shah receives a troubling diagnosis. His doctor informs him that he has leukemia. Upon this news, the monarch will travel to his holiday home by the Caspian Sea to convalesce, despite the crisis simmering in his country. But his time away will be far from relaxing. During the Shah's absence, demonstrations against his regime will reach a fever pitch as a series of devastating events draw widespread uproar, setting Iran on a course for revolution. It's the evening of August 19, 1978, in Abadan in southwest Iran, 5 months before the Shah will be forced into exile. A college student takes her seat at the Cinema Rex movie theater. As the lights go down, a ripple of excitement passes through the auditorium. The college student smiles eagerly as she awaits for the picture to start. Tonight's film is a political drama called The Deer. It's a controversial movie because it does something that in recent years has become a dangerous act of rebellion in Iran. It tells the truth about life under the Shah. Ever since the 1953 coup d'etat that toppled Iran's elected prime minister, the Shah has been steadily maneuvering himself into a position of unrivaled authority. Wishing to modernize the country, the Shah introduced a program of reforms that radically changed the face of the nation. By dismantling the traditional landowning class in the countryside, the Shah's reforms caused mass migration of unemployed agricultural workers to the cities. This resulted in a rise in homelessness and poverty as millions of unskilled peasant laborers struggled to find employment in urban areas. The Shah's reforms might have strengthened the economy and increased living conditions for those at the top of society, but they have also increased inequality, widening the gap between rich and poor, a trend many of tonight's moviegoers hope to see highlighted on screen. The projector starts to whir and a beam of light cuts through the dark auditorium, casting flickering cinematic images across the big screen. Like most of her classmates, the young college student is staunchly left-wing and a fierce critic of the Shah. So as soon as the film starts, she is immediately transfixed. But only a few minutes into the movie, a piercing scream rings from the back of the theater. The student turns around, immediately recoiling from the intense heat and powerful smell of gasoline. Flames have engulfed the main entrance to the auditorium, and an angry red wall of fire now belches black smoke into the room. Pandemonium erupts as the moviegoers leap from their seats and begin desperately searching for an escape route. But the college student is frozen, paralyzed with fear. She stares in horror as people try to barge through the doors into the foyer, but they won't open because somebody has barred the exit. As the inferno spreads, consuming everything in its path, it dawns on the college student that the fire was no accident. And to her mind, there is only one possible culprit, the Savak, the Shah's thuggish secret police force. Since the film being shown tonight was critical of the Shah's regime, the Savak must have plotted this attack to send a message to anyone foolish enough to question the wisdom and authority of the Shah. The fire at the Cinema Rex claims the lives of over 400 people in what is the deadliest terrorist attack in history until 9/11. Though the true perpetrators of the attack are still unknown to this day, many Iranians blame the Savak. To the opponents of the Shah, this atrocity is further evidence that they are living under a reign of terror. Following the Cinema Rex fire, anti-Shah demonstrations erupt across Iran. On September 8, 1978, thousands of protesters flock to a square in Tehran, chanting death to the Shah. The protesters come from a broad cross-section of society. There are left-wing activists, students, and members of the intelligentsia. There are religious demonstrators, traditional Muslims who believe the Shah has become too steeped in Western decadence. And finally, there are members of the working class poor, the masses who form the traditional base of support for the monarchy, but who have been plunged into poverty by the Shah's socioeconomic reforms. Together, they form the many thousands of protesters in the square calling for an end of tyranny and the end of the Shah. But unbeknownst to the protesters, the Shah is not currently in Iran. Ever since his leukemia diagnosis 4 years ago, the ailing monarch has been spending more time at his vacation retreat on the Caspian Sea. While protests against his regime cripple the country, the Shah has grown increasingly insular. He spends long hours staring out the window, expressionless and silent. But when informed about the most recent protests in Tehran, the Shah gives a fateful order. He authorizes the military to open fire on the demonstrators. Shortly after issuing this command, bullets tear through the crowds in the square. And by the time the shooting stops, more than 60 protesters have been killed. The violent crackdown will be remembered as Black Friday, and it will mark the point of no return for the Shah. Soon after this incident in Tehran, a general strike will shut down Iran's oil industry, cutting off the lifeblood of the monarch's regime. In a last-ditch effort at appeasement, the Shah will speak on live television, stating that he has heard the voice of the revolution and promises reforms. But his words will not be enough. Soon the Shah will decide that the only course of action is to entrust the leadership of Iran to the prime minister and flee the country himself, leaving the path clear for revolution. It's February 1st, 1979, 2 weeks after the Shah fled Iran. A chartered Air France passenger plane begins its initial descent over Tehran. On board, a 78-year-old man with a long white beard gazes through the window at the city below. After 15 years in exile, Ayatollah Khomeini is finally coming home. the senior religious leader was expelled from the country in 1964 after publicly criticizing the Shah. But even from exile in Paris, the Ayatollah continued to coordinate the revolution, writing fiery screeds and promoting dissent. When mass demonstrations resulted in the Shah fleeing the country, the path became clear for the Ayatollah to return. Now he intends to finish what the people started, to brush aside the vestiges of monarchy and turn Iran into a true Islamic republic. The plane touches down with a squeal of rubber on tarmac. Shortly after, descending a flight of stairs, the elderly cleric is met with deafening cheers from his supporters, who have flocked to the airport to welcome their leader. But the Ayatollah neither waves nor smiles. He remains stony-faced as his security detail ushers him through the crowds toward a waiting car. In the weeks following the Ayatollah's return, armed battles continue to rage in the streets of Iran. The Ayatollah's supporters clash with the forces of the government left in charge by the Shah. Soon, though, the revolutionaries triumph. They take control of key government buildings, army barracks, and police stations. The prime minister himself flees, and the military withdraws. On April 1st, following a national referendum, Ayatollah Khomeini declares Iran an Islamic republic, of which he is the supreme leader. In the months following the Iranian Revolution, the Ayatollah will exclude all other revolutionary factions from positions of power in his new regime. Neither the leftists, members of the intelligentsia, or labor leaders will find a place in government. He will launch the so-called Cultural Revolution, purging Iran's universities and schools of Western or non-Islamic ideas. Laws protecting women's rights will be abolished. Homosexuality will be made punishable by death. And strict Islamic codes will be enforced across the country. The new Islamic Republic becomes more and more authoritarian, and the reign of the Ayatollah will gradually assume many of the characteristics of the monarchy it replaced. The Iranian Revolution of 1979 will continue to cast a long shadow across Middle Eastern geopolitics for years to come. The rise of political Islamism, spearheaded by the Ayatollah Khomeini, will become a central factor in future tensions between East and West. And today, the strict dress codes imposed by the Ayatollah are still in place. In 2022, these laws attracted a fresh wave of international scrutiny when a young woman was arrested for improperly wearing her head covering in public and later died while in police custody. This crime triggered a new wave of protests across the country in a mass outpouring of anger at a repressive regime, the likes of which had rarely been seen since the demonstrations that forced the Shah to flee Iran decades prior on January 16, 1979. Next on History Daily, January 17, 1964, author Roald Dahl publishes one of his most enduring works, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. From Noiser and Airship, this is History Daily, hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham. Audio editing by Molly Bach. Sound design by Derek Behrens. Music by Lindsey Graham. This episode is written and researched by Joe Viner. Produced by Alexandra Curry Buckner. Executive producers are Stephen Walters for Airship and Pascal Hughes for Noiser.